buying nothing, think about changing the paradigm and shifting from a consumerist culture to a culture where we can really based in mutual aid and compassion for each other. Let's make the world new with creative endeavors. See you next week.
Tune in every Friday at 3 p.m. for Roots of Rock and Roll. Dale Farr and Steve Bricker play rare and vintage records from rhythm and blues, jump blues, rockabilly, and doo-wop. From the birth of rock and roll to the 50s and early 60s. Roots of Rock and Roll, only on KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 9:03 a.m. Coming up at next, we hear the first of two programs recorded as part of the History of Social Justice Organizing series. First, a panel of outstanding long-term LGBTQ activists speak out on the history of the movement in Portland, including Steve Fulmer, Susie Seifers, Cliff Jones, and Pat Young. At 10:30, we'll hear another panel discussion recorded as part of the series. Four members of the legendary Mountain Moving Cafe discuss the history of the Mountain Moving Cafe, exploring collectives at work. The panelists are Ellen Goldberg, Andy Clark, Kieran O'Hara, and Peter Thacker. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm. Click where it says Donate Today. Stay tuned.
Welcome to our first History of Social Justice Organizing program of the year, of this school year. Okay, so this is a rather special evening because I've never done this before, but I'm going to dedicate this evening. I knew this was going to happen to me. Sorry. To the memory of two wonderful and important Portlanders. In 1973, Rita Knapp testified before an Oregon House committee saying, "I am the parent of a gay woman." It was the first time a parent had spoken for a gay child in a public meeting where the press was present. She went on to co-found with her husband Chuck and Susie Shepherd, here's parents, Ann and Bill Shepherd, the Parents of Gays, which was the first support group for parents in Portland. It later affiliated with National PFLAG, eventually hosting a National PFLAG conference here in Portland. Rita died 3 weeks ago after a long illness. Her husband, Chuck, died on April 19th. We had hoped to have Kristen here tonight, but I don't see her. I know it's not an easy time for her. She's an amazing activist in her own right, and we're really sorry for her loss. So we're honoring her and her parents tonight for their contribution to LGBTQ equal rights. And you can read a whole lot more. You can read a lot more about Rita on the Glopin website, and it's just glopin.org. Now, our panel on the history of lesbian, gay, bi, trans, queer community. Sometimes it's hard for me to remember that in 1970, how closeted the community was, how discriminated against, how quiet. With the founding of the Gay Liberation Front in 1970, the slow climb to equality began. Obviously, we can only touch on a fraction of it tonight. There's a whole lot more on the Gay and Lesbian Archives of the Pacific Northwest website, and I encourage you to check it out, get their brochure out there. It'll make it really easy. It's a great resource. George Nicola from Glopin is here tonight, as well as Pat Young, who's on the panel. So you can talk to them afterwards and get more information. So here's the panel, starting from there, sitting in the order they're going to speak. First, we have Steve Fulmer, who has worked for so many different organizations. I decided I couldn't take the time to read them all, but maybe he'll tell you the ones that matter the most to him. And I think we all know that he was one of the founders of the Portland Gay Men's Chorus. Next, we have Susie Shepherd. She worked for the Portland Town Council. She was their first employee. She co-wrote the Legislative Guide to Gay Rights, and she chairs the Bill and Ann Shepherd Legal Scholarship Fund of the Equity Foundation, as well as being a recipient of the Equity Foundation's Lifetime Achievement Award. Next, we have Cliff Jones. He's been active in the gay community since the early 80s. He co-founded Black Lesbians and Gays United. He worked at Cascade AIDS Project. He co-founded Brother to Brother and a whole lot of other things. Pat Young, the one on the end of the table, is going to tell you the story of trying to get health benefits extended to gay employees at Tektronix. And she also worked to defeat the 92 anti-gay measure 9. And she now teaches LGBTQ history capstone class here at PSU. She also works with Glopin. And we've also got our history checker here tonight, George Nicola. He's been a gay activist since he got involved in 1970. And since his retirement, he's been chronicling the movement's history with Glopin. So I'm just going to turn it over to Steve, who's number one.
So my remarks are prepared so that I can stay inside 10 minutes. And I will talk fast. If you'd like a copy, I did prepare some copies. So it's truly a pleasure to be participating this evening with such an august panel. It's actually rare to be able to look at the past 40 years from the perspective of sexual minority rights. My primary contributions took place in the 80s and 90s, but I was certainly present and active in the 70s as well. Not surprisingly, I changed right along with the times, becoming the retired walrus you see before you now. But in the 1970s, I was a student here at Portland State University, a skinny hippie in my 20s with a huge afro. When I arrived here in 1972, I quickly connected with the local Gay Liberation Front and PSU's Gay Student Alliance. Within 6 months, I found myself co-chairing the young PSU group, which was immediately renamed the Gay and Lesbian Student Alliance. Thanks largely to lesbians who befriended me, I immersed myself in women's studies and black studies and was greatly impressed by four writers: Simone de Beauvoir, who authored The Second Sex; Bayard Rustin, his collected writings. He was one of the luminaries of the NAACP. Carl Whitman, who wrote the Gay Manifesto, which I almost memorized at the time. And Dennis Altman, who wrote a book called Homosexual Oppression and Liberation. GLSA's, that's the Gay Liberation, the Gay and Lesbian Student Alliance's office in the Student Activities Center was next to the Women's Union and the Black Student Group, and we learned a lot from them. In retrospect, I now realize that what we had there in that office complex in the mid-1970s was a microcosm of what was happening all across America. Bear in mind that MLK's famous March on Washington was in August of 63. Cesar Chavez formed the United Farm Workers in 66, and the second wave of feminism resulted in the founding of the National Organization for Women, NOW, in the same year. The first anti-war march in November of 65 had 30,000 demonstrators, and it swelled to 600,000 by late 1969. Youth from across America were questioning everything in what was called the counterculture craze. And by the mid-70s, women were holding huge music festivals in the heartland of Illinois, Michigan, and Ohio. I know that it's popular to date the so-called gay liberation movement to the Stonewall riots in New York City in 1969. But it's very important, in my opinion, to understand the cultural backdrop that led to what really proved to be the gay rights movement in the 1970s. I'll come back to this theme in a moment, but first, I'll give you a snapshot of what was happening in Portland in the early 1970s. Here on campus, we were disrupting sex education classes. We called it zapping. Those sex education classes were still teaching that homosexuals were maladaptive. And we got the most egregious professor to resign. We picketed the new film, Boys in the Band, because we felt its portrayals were depressing and stereotypical. We sponsored groups as alternatives, discussion groups as alternatives to the bars, and spoke in any area classroom that would have us. In Greater Portland, I was involved with the Second Foundation, which formed as a middle ground between the radical socialism of the Gay Liberation Front and what was then a very conservative imperial court system. Second Foundation offered social alternatives for youth and elders outside the bars and the court system and began publishing The Fountain, Portland's first newspaper by and for sexual minority people. They led the way toward creating what we now know as an actual community of sexual minority people. They backed an amazing one-man army named George Nicola, who got the first gay rights bill introduced in the Oregon legislature. I was one of George's few sidekicks who lobbied the bill to within a single vote. Second Foundation then went out of business, and it was replaced by Portland Town Council and Phoenix Rising, and you'll hear more about that, I'm sure, from Susie. By way of comment, one of the fundamental aspects of all nonviolent civil disobedience, certainly as taught by Bayard Rustin, is visibility. Visibility. And in my humble opinion, it was the large anti-war marches in Portland that really gave us, sexual minority people, the most visibility. Because for the first time, sexual minority people marched together as a contingent, proudly declaring our identity in public in front of news cameras. It wasn't until 1976 that Portland had its first gay parade and rally, at first characterized by protest, which eventually turned into the celebrations of pride that we have today. It took all of these things, African-American protest, Latino protest, women's protest, the counterculture, and the anti-Vietnam War movement to really create the environment for sexual minority people to unite and fight for our own recognition as equal members of society. I also want to stress another vital contributor, and you might not hear of this in anything that you read, because, and I want to stress this because of the lesson it teaches us today. That contributor at the time, my friends, was the complacency of the homophobic establishment, which was very slow to react to our initial efforts in the 1970s. I mention it now, knowing that they soon did react, grew strong, and even today maintain control of the Republican Party nationwide. The lesson for us today, having won some measure of equality in Oregon and elsewhere, is that we must never take our rights for granted. We ourselves must never grow complacent, or the Ayatollahs of the right will surely seek to return us to hiding in fear. Before I move on to a quick summary of the 1980s, I would like to bring attention to another small but extraordinary force in those days, one which reminded me of the power of music because, you see, I was also a choral activist. I witnessed the impact of folks like Peter, Paul, and Mary, Joan Baez, and Arlo Guthrie in the anti-war movement. Later in the 80s, I would gain much credit as founding president of the Portland Gay Men's Chorus. The importance of the chorus cannot be underestimated, not only as a cultural contributor, but as a nearly unassailable political force. After all, how do you go about hating a chorus? But the first sexual minority singing group in Portland was not PGMC. In the early 70s, I had the great good fortune of singing in a small faggot-assisted dyke choir called Ursa Minor, led by Naomi Littlebear, then Kristen Knapp's partner. Kristen came into the back of the room. The work of Ursa Minor influenced formation of the dyke tones and complemented street theater groups like the Family Circus. I mention Ursa Minor tonight to underscore their influence on my own political development and that of many others. In the 80s and 90s, I went on to help found Cascade AIDS Project, Portland Public Schools Sexual Minority Task Force, and the Equity Foundation, and to serve in a variety of other human rights and human services organizations in Multnomah County. I'd like to stress one last factor in our success in the 1980s and 90s. I do not believe that we could be where we are today without the horrors of the HIV epidemic. Quite simply, a silver lining of those hellish years was that it forced so many people out of the closet. It brought visibility, there's that word again, visibility on a very human level that we had never had before. Average Americans realized that their box boy, their minister, their favorite movie star were gay. The early epidemic, in effect, was our war fought in the headlines of America. So my closing comment to you, and especially to past, current, or aspiring activists who may be present tonight, is to never forget, even in the moments of greatest challenge or fatigue, that what you do to advance the humanity of others will have great effects, even though you may not be aware of those effects at the time. I would never have done what I did without the inspiration of people like George Nicola and Kristen Knapp. So on dark days, never think that you are failing to progress, for it may be your influence on others, even more than the battles of today, which will eventually bring about desperately needed changes in our city, our region, our nation, or our planet. For I truly believe that what we do on behalf of others always makes a difference. Thank you.
I always knew I was gay, and I came out to my folks a year or two after Stonewall, and they weren't thrilled about it, but just didn't want it talked about a whole lot, didn't want me to bring anybody home, and that was fine. I didn't have anybody to bring home in those days. Anyhow, I finished up down at the University of Oregon, and there was a Gay Student Alliance down there, and we had a great poster. It was pale pink and pale blue, and it had a big bird and a big bee, and it said, "That ain't all." And I kept that thing forever, and I think it finally, after one move, it got lost. But when I was down there, I got to meet Terry Bean, who would go on to be known by all of us for the incredible contributions that he's made to our movement. He was president of the student body down there at the time. But after I graduated, a student talk at the Job Corps Center up in Astoria, and had to be in the closet while I was doing that. And after I graduated, I substituted there for a little while, and then I got called into Vista Service, which I really wanted to do, and was sent off to Oklahoma for about 15 months and had to go back into the closet being there, which I didn't mind going into the closet to be back there. I mean, it was just 1973, and I really, really wanted to serve my country, and it was a wonderful way to get to do it. When I was wrapping up my time in Vista, I got a contract to teach at Siusla Junior High School in Florence, Oregon, and so I spent that next summer at home, and it was a time that I really, really wanted to be. I would go down to the gay bars. Kristen had taken me to my first gay bar, so I knew where all three of them that women were okay to go to in Portland were at that time, and had to go back into the closet to be back there teaching in Florence, and that was a horrible thing to do. Anyone who's ever been in the closet and has to go back in knows that closets shrink exponentially once you've been out of them. I mean, a closet that you could have lived in okay before all of a sudden gets about that big, and it was a horrible thing to have to do. I was the only second single woman on the staff there at the junior high, and that's such an obnoxious age anyhow, and it was an absolutely awful year. But I had two really life-altering things happen during the second half of the year. Spawned by my very suicidal, increasingly alcoholic, having to be in the closet kinds of things. And that was that I would come to Eugene every Tuesday for therapy with a psychologist so I wouldn't kill myself and sort of get by that time. Well, at that time, my sister, Jean, was a journalism student at the U of O, and she had a friend who was gay who was doing, at this point, 1974, he was doing an article for some small Willamette Valley newspaper about people who had to live in the closet, but were trying to make a life as a gay person, and he wanted to interview me. And I said, okay, but he can't use my name because I'll lose my job, and they understood that. So he did this interview, and I read the article, and it was all about me, but it wasn't my name. And I could not wrap my head around that. It was, who was this person who was living my life, whose name I didn't know? It was absolutely horrifying. I will fast forward a number of years and tell you that the name of that journalism student was Randy Schultz, who many of you will know went on to write And the Band Played On, and he was a close friend of my sister's. We were good acquaintances, and he wrote so well, but reading about myself as another person galvanized me to where I absolutely had to get involved somehow and do something. One of those weekends or weeks that I was in Portland, and I went to Portland whenever I could, I was at Zorba the Greek's bar, which is now some French restaurant up there on Park Avenue, and George, I think, and a few other people were passing out sign-up sheets for the Portland Town Council, which in December of 1974 passed a resolution, not an ordinance, but a resolution, making against the policy of the city of Portland to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation in hiring and firing. Connie McCready was mayor at the time, and the best they could do was get a resolution, but that was a lot more than we had before. So I signed up to get on the mailing list, and those monthly newsletters that came saved my life. I was living up there in Florence, up in the woods, away from everybody, and it was horrifying. And that newsletter was my lifeline, and I knew that when I got back to Portland that I would absolutely get involved with this organization. Well, in the meantime, I got involved with somebody who was extremely closeted and told me, oh, I couldn't get involved. If I did, that would be the end of our relationship. So for a long time after I came back to Portland, I was trying to balance that. One of the things that happened before I came back, I spent spring break that year on the campus at U of O. House Measure, whatever it was in the Oregon legislature to try to make it legal or illegal to discriminate on the basis of housing, employment, public accommodations, on the basis of not only sexual orientation, but also marital status, because at that time, single people were still very much discriminated against. I think it's also important as a backdrop to note that in 1971, the Oregon Criminal Code had a massive reorganization, and at that time, acts of sodomy between consenting adults were no longer made illegal. So that was, we thought we got our freedom with that, you know, and then getting forward thinking we had to start looking at our civil rights. Anyhow, so I was in Eugene one day out on the campus having people come and sign postcards, and this man came up with an umbrella, nice-looking man, his umbrella's all wrapped up, it wasn't raining, and we explained what we were doing, and I was with my friend Harriet Merrick, who I know some of you guys know, and we explained what it was. And he said, you know what I think they ought to do with all those homosexuals? I said, no. I didn't know which homosexuals he meant, but I said, what should they do with those homosexuals? He said, I think they should line them up against the wall, and he picks up his umbrella and go, I said, you know, I'm gay, and I don't think that's a really good idea. And he said, oh, I didn't mean anything personal. So between that and reading about myself as somebody who I didn't know, even though she was living my life, I knew I had to get involved. And so I finally, by that fall, was getting involved with Portland Town Council. And actually, in the fall of 75, we had the first, we didn't call it Pride then. I can't remember what we called it. It was a harvest gathering. It was right over here in the South Park blocks. Portland Town Council put it on. I brought my accordion and played my two little gay rights songs that I had written. And here's where my pride was at that time. My partner was still so closeted, she refused to be seen in public with me doing anything gay. So she's driving around the block, waiting for me to sing my song so I could then jump in the back of the car and have her drive me off. So that's how proud I was in 1975, but I was trying. It was a process. I really loved her. She was a wonderful woman. But I didn't know how to do this thing, and I got more and more involved. And Larry Copeland at the time was, actually, he was the first paid staff at Portland Town Council. I got on the board, and he asked if he could get a stipend of like $200 a month. My God, he wasn't making any money at all. We had no answering machines in those days. There was nothing. There was either a telephone, if you wanted to talk to somebody, or you would go knock on their door. That was it. Larry often slept. We had a little tiny office down in the building there where Huber's is. Larry would often sleep on the floor of that little tiny office so that if any suicidal gay person called, he wouldn't miss their call, and they might have a chance to live through a suicidal night. That is how committed Larry was to this cause. Larry was the one who got through the city ordinance with Mayor McCready. He was doing this and literally saving lives as he was doing it. And he had this wonderful volunteer named Dennis Bright. He would sit there with this old manual Underwood typewriter and patiently hand type the labels for those newsletters that helped save my life just a few months before. that would go out with the monthly newsletter. It was the old things where we'd have to hand press on the headlines for the stories we wrote. I mean, I look at how fast things come together now, and everything was so incredibly slow. I mean, we didn't think so, but I look at it now in retrospect, and it's amazing. Lurie had an idea that he thought that Governor Straub should point a task force to determine whether discrimination existed throughout the state on the basis of sexual orientation. He went through Gladys McCoy, who later became a state senator. At the time, she was state ombudsman person, and she made that thing happen. And that task force was charged with reporting to the 1977 legislature whether or not discrimination existed statewide. Mother was appointed to that. Thank you. Oh, dear God in heaven. And called herself the token mother on the committee. They went around the state. They made the report to the task force that, yes, indeed, there was discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. One of the things they needed to do was to start a parent support group. Mother knew that Rita had testified at the 73 legislature, and after that happened, she asked her how she could help, and Rita said, you could testify in 75, which Mother did. At Portland Town Council, Larry gave me a job of putting together a brochure called A Legislative Guide to Gay Rights that we could hand out to the 77 legislature. It turned out to be an 80-some page booklet that was so huge a project, I needed to pull in experts from the fields of religion, education, and so on. It was a massive project. It won rave reviews in the National Gay Press because there still was very little stuff coming out from Stonewall, and ended up being distributed around the world and going into a second printing. We still didn't get our civil rights bill through, but what we did in terms of putting Portland Town Council and the work we were doing on the map was incredible. By then, Larry had left Portland Town Council, and Jerry Weller had come into town from the East Coast. Jerry took us to a whole new level. His organizing skills were incomparable, and he was an incredibly good friend with Reverend Troy Perry, who founded Metropolitan Community Church, who had such a global vision. And when the two of them talked, oh my God, it was amazing the things that would happen. Getting to work first with Larry and then with Jerry was the most incredible experience of my life. I will try to pull this together very quickly. The work that Mother Dad did in founding what was first called POG, Parents of Gays, that later became PFLAG, they were honored by a man named Jeffrey Rose, who was Mr. Portland Leather. In 1993, when Jeff was stepping down in 1994, he started a scholarship fund in their name. We decided to make it a legal scholarship so as not to compete with the other two then existing gay scholarships, Pride of the Rose and Audrey M. Edwards. And I did bring a few brochures out there. But this goes on to help law students who are entering their last year of law school who are committed to continuing the battles of bigotry and discrimination. One of the things that Daddy did in the mid-70s was to constantly take Portland police to court. They were arresting gay men in downtown restrooms, filing trumped-up sex charges against them, ruining their lives, ruining their reputations. Daddy and a very, very small handful of other attorneys were willing to take these people on. Mother used her skills as a newspaper reporter to get people to open up, whether it was gay people trying to figure out how to come out to their kids or their parents or whoever, gay parents who didn't know what to do with their gay kids. Being back living at home at that time was the most amazing experience. There were two huge things that really helped break the movement open. I know I'm going over, but I got to share these two. One was a town hall program on Channel 2 in May of 1977. The other was the Oregon Journal headline that's on the brochure here. Portland parents learn to deal with gay children. I'm homosexual. It's my coming out story. They printed it on Gay Pride Day that year. For the first time, they finally started printing Mother and Dad's phone number in the paper and on the news. That opened the floodgates. Before then, Mother had been trying to get a classified ad saying, do you have a gay child? We can help. All the papers refused. We can't do that, Ann. We're a family paper. A tiny classified ad. They would not do it for over a year. Finally, with the front page story and with the news coverage on KETU, it broke the movement absolutely wide open. Sorry I ran over.
Sandy, could we take 3 to 4 minutes and just let people talk with each other to say what they've heard and just why they came, just so that we're not talking at folks for 40 minutes.
Yeah. I feel about that. The trouble is that it's for KBOO, and so I have to take the mic around.
No, I mean talk to each other.
To each other.
Mm-hmm. So I can set it up. So if you would just turn to someone next to you and just chat for a couple minutes about what you've heard, why you came, what your reactions are, what you're learning, what you're feeling being here. Just chat for 2 to 3 minutes.
Go.
Don't be shy. Don't be shy.
You are listening to a panel of lesbian, gay, bi, trans, queer activists speaking on the history of LGBTQ activism in Portland. It was recorded on October 24th as part of the History of Social Justice Organizing series. The activists on the panel are Steve Fulmer, Susie Shepard, Cliff Jones, and Pat Young. This is KBOO Portland.
Hi, we're all done. Thank you.
So I want to thank Sandy and folks who helped her for organizing this. I also want to thank you for coming. I want to acknowledge my best friend, Rupert Kennard. Raise your hand, Rupert. Yay. Rupert and I have known each other since 1981, so we tease each other often when we start to tell stories that we can really clock each other if we're going off script. So if Rupert sort of raises his hands and snaps, it might mean that I'm going off script because he knows everything about me. I also want to acknowledge Kathleen Sadat, who is a good friend and mentor, and Amani Jabari, who died from AIDS in 1991, and who also was a good friend and mentor. And Amani, Kathleen Sadat, Rupert, and Elizabeth Waters and I co-founded Black Lesbians Engage United in about 1984-85. You know, as we've heard, that we could be here for 2 days talking about the movement, gay liberation in Portland. And I'm going to focus and talk through one of my lenses, which is as a black man and a black gay man, because it's an interesting lens. So, you know, I came out in the late 70s, and I remember the first time I went to a gay bar, I was in Tacoma, Washington. My assumption was, being a black person growing up in the 60s and 70s, my awareness of oppression, my awareness of discrimination, my awareness of the civil rights movement was heightened. It had been a part of, as I learned to read, I learned about the struggle against oppression. So my assumption was, coming into a gay community, that gay men and lesbians would have a similar awareness about rights. And I'll never forget, I went into this gay bar in Tacoma after having passed it for probably 20 times. And then when I finally got the courage up to walk in and sat down at the bar, and I started talking to this guy, and I don't know how we got into the conversation, but in 1978 he said, if we had a black president, nothing would be different. He'd just do the same thing that white presidents do. And I just thought, you must be crazy. You must be crazy. Maybe he wasn't, but what it said to me was that there was a very different lens and perspective and experience that people have based on what they bring to a gay, lesbian, bisexual identity. And so, you know, that was a first clue I got. I moved to Portland in 1980, and immediately, you know, I'm just coming out, sort of fresh start in Portland, and I got involved with, I actually came in like August, and so the Pride March and Festival and rally had already happened, and I was going out to bars trying to meet people, and somehow got involved in this group that was meeting from every month. It was called TKO. It was a group of activists, of gay lesbian activists, and that were meeting monthly to debate whether we should change the name of Gay Pride to Lesbian and Gay Pride. Now, I was mystified why you would need to meet a year to make that decision. It was sort of obvious to me, but we did, and it was very interesting. So that was my entree into the gay lesbian community. And so, through a lot of struggle and a lot of disagreement, we agreed that we would change the name to Lesbian and Gay Pride. I think from my perspective, it just shows how, as a movement, we have different relationships with privilege and power. And, that really was a split between white gay men, lesbians, and people of color who were gay. It was just like, I think to the women and people of color, it was clear that everyone needed a voice, everyone needed to be represented, and gay did not equal lesbian. So it was interesting, the discourse and the conversations that we had, listening to each other, and we had heated debates about this. And so I went on that year to be part of the Pride Planning Committee, and I wrote a grant to involve more people of color in Lesbian and Gay Pride. I wrote the grant to MRG Foundation. I was still coming out. It's 1982. As you all talked, what I'm reminded of is it's hard to remember today the risk one faced coming out. You faced violence, you faced loss of housing, you faced loss of employment. And so just identifying yourself as a gay man or a lesbian put you at risk. So it was really an act of courage to be out. And I remember very clearly when I wrote the grant for MRG, you know how people get grants in at the last minute. And so there are like 10 of us at the door of MRG waiting for the staff person to come back because we want to make sure our grant gets turned in. And I remember a colleague who I worked with in my in the field I worked in. I was working in nonprofits. She was at the door turning in a grant. She said, "Oh, what grant are you turning in?" And I just had this moment of panic. And I couldn't even tell her. I just let her read the cover page of the grant. I couldn't even say it. I was just waiting to see what her reaction was. So, it's amazing to me that 30 years later, I don't think about the challenges of being out. You know, it's sort of like I'm out. You know, if you don't like it, too bad. Back then, I was very, very worried. I wrote that grant. We got the grant. And the Gay Pride Committee then asked me to come to a board meeting because they wanted me to justify why I had written the grant to include people of color and why I had not made it available for other activities. And I was young. I was very young. And Amani Jabari and Kathleen Sadat, when they heard I was going to go to that meeting, decided that they would go with me. And after a lot of ridiculous deliberation, Kathleen Sadat stood up and started pacing. And Amani said, "Uh-oh, she's pacing." And then, in her pace, she said, "Apologize to the man and let us go home." And then she, because they were saying I had manipulated them, and then she said, "Manipulated you into what? Involving some people of color and lesbian and gay pride?" And so my point is that we have all the struggles within the gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans community as we have without it. So racism, sexism, classism are alive and well, and we have to struggle around those issues and understand our relationship with those issues. The other thing that I noticed when I came to Portland, and let's face it, bars was how you got to know people. Bars was our community center, our employment center, our everything. And so back then, you wanted to find stuff out, you went to bars. And I'd go to bars, and none of the black men would speak to me. And I was just like, this is strange. And that's when I met Rupert. Rupert and I got together, and we just started bringing together black gay men. And then pretty soon someone said they knew a lesbian, a black lesbian who might be interested. And so we got together. We planned to have a potluck with the black men that Rupert and I and others had organized and the black lesbians that were meeting. And we came together and we started having monthly potlucks. And it was, I cannot tell you how wonderful it was to come together with black gay men and lesbians. We just felt like at home. It was like we could relax, we could feel safe, we could have the familiarity of all of our cultural framework and trapping and just the things that we did together as black people, and we could be fully out and do the things that we did as gay men and lesbians. So it was incredibly liberating and really drove home to me the importance of creating space for people of similar cultural backgrounds within any movement to come together, just how valuable that was. So, you know, we came together for about 4 or 5 years, and really what challenged that group was HIV, was AIDS. You know, we were rocked by AIDS just like everyone else was, and even then, there were disparities. It had a huge impact on black gay men. And so we didn't know how to talk about it. We didn't know what to do. people were getting sick. We didn't know what was going on. And so in the early 90s, black gay men came together, sort of replicating that experience of we need a space to deal with what this means through our experience and through our lens. You know, what does it mean to be a black gay man in a time where people are dying of AIDS and where all of the service organizations are white and when stigma is attached to it? I was the first person of color on staff at Cascade AIDS Project, and I remember black men would come through there and they wouldn't want to see me. They wouldn't want me to see them because of the stigma. Black people going into white service providers, you know, which was great that those resources were there, but those are the kind of issues that brother to brother came together to struggle with. And Rupert was, actually the first meeting was at Rupert's house, where 40 black gay men came together to talk about that. And we had some glorious times. And I'll just close with, one thing we did was we got some money from the health department and we brought about 40 black gay men in a weekend retreat just to talk about how you survive in these times. And we had people in the group do workshops. And, you know, again, it was that feeling of home, that feeling of safety, that feeling of building capacity within our community. So, you know, my journey as a black gay man has been a very parallel journey of what it means to be black, to be in black community with other black people and people of color immersed in a larger white gay movement, and how we partner, how we don't, how we build connections, how we build understanding, how we build alliances, and how at times it feels like the racism of the larger community. So thank you. I'll stop there. I think I'm up over time.
Okay, my name is Pat Young, and I'm going to talk about what it was like for me to try to get health benefits extended to the partners of gay employees of Tektronix. So, I don't know if you're familiar with Tektronix, but it was a homegrown high-tech company, sort of like Intel, only Oregon's version, and now it's a very small company because it went through all these layoffs. But at the time when I worked there, middle of the 80s through most of the 90s, it was a number one good place to work in terms of benefits and paychecks and things like that. And they had thousands and thousands of employees. So in 1991, there was a movement going on for companies to, for some companies to extend health benefits to domestic partners. And if you receive those health benefits, if you were like working for Levi Strauss or IBM or something, as an employee, you would be taxed on that as if it was extra income. So I'm at Tektronix now in 1991, and my partner at that time had lost her job. So I thought, okay, I'm going to try to get health benefits extended to domestic partners. And I went to my immediate human resource representative and asked her what to do. And she went up the ladder to Ed Niebert, who was head of the benefits program. And Ed wrote back through Janine to me that what I needed to do was to write a letter explaining why I wanted health benefits extended to the partners of gay employees. And I had to find 15 people to sign the letter. So, including myself, so that would be 14 people I had to find. And he said I could either have them put their initials so that they could be anonymous, or they could sign their whole names. So I thought, piece of cake, you know. I can spot gay people. This is going to be really easy. So the first person I asked was this man I used to see in the cafeteria every morning when I would get my cup of hot tea. And he was about my height, and he had this thick handlebar mustache, you know, his pants were just a little bit too tight. And so I said, hey, you know, do you have a few minutes to talk to me before we go back to work? And he goes, okay. So we sat down in the cafeteria and I told him my whole story, what I was trying to do. And I asked if he would sign my letter. And he goes, well, why do you want me to sign your letter? And he goes, I'm not gay. And I said, you know, I just didn't hardly knew what to say. I thought for sure he was gay. And then he goes, well, how's it going? And I said, well, not very well, because you're the first person I've asked. So after that, I decided to network. And people have mentioned potlucks. I don't know if lesbians are still having potlucks, but certainly in 1990, there were always potlucks everywhere. So I found a potluck. And I took my little Tektronix business cards, and I went up to everybody and explained what I was doing. And at that moment, I kind of realized, you know, oh, my God, I'm, like, really out now, you know. And I had one hit on that. Was a woman who worked in Wilsonville, which is where my plant was. She worked in the different building, but she did not want to sign my letter because she was very closeted. She didn't even want to put her initials on it. But she knew somebody in my building who was gay. So I went over and I met Ron, and that's how we started networking. Ron knew somebody, and I'd take my letter with me, and I would, you know, have them sign it, and I'd make a Xerox copy, and I'd put one on my desk, and I'd keep one in my pocket. And this went on and on, and it took me a month to find the other 14 people. But of the saddest story, I went to visit Jose, who was working in a Beaverton office. And it was on my lunch break, so I drove up to Beaverton, you know, ran into his building. We're sitting in this little conference room. And even before I could talk, Jose started to say to me, I have HIV. I'm starting to get sick. I know I've got AIDS now. What do I do? Do I tell my boss? You know, what's Tektronix going to do? Am I going to lose my job? And I was, like, horrified because he was asking me all these questions. I didn't have a clue what to say to him other than try going to your human resource person and maybe they'll help you. I don't know. He did sign my letter, and unfortunately he died about 3 years later, but that was just a real tragedy that went on. So now we're getting close to a month has passed by, and I needed one more signature. And I don't know if all of you have worked at one of these corporations where it's like you're in a big warehouse and all these little cubicles, so it's like a maze. And I'm 5'4", so if you're 5'4" or shorter, It's like a rat maze, okay? If you're taller, it's a whole new world because you can see over the barriers. So Ron and I were standing in one of these little aisleways, and I'm on my tippy toes like this, and he's like this tall, and we're going, there goes one. And he says, no, I thought so too, but he's married. And I go, really? And then we go, there goes one. And so... I don't know how we did it, but we finally got the 14 signatures. And what was so impressive to me is four people put their initials. Everyone else signed their full name. So I sent this off to Ed Niebert, and this would have been December of 1991. And that kind of started this long process that really lasted 3.5 years. So to give you the ending of the story, Tektronix never passed health benefits for us gay folks, the employees. But what I did is I passed that message on, and I kept checking in with people. You know, well, how far are we in the process? Who do I have to talk to? And while I was doing this, Chris Tanner, who worked at OHSU, and a group of other employees were also trying to get health benefits extended to their partners. So Chris Tanner she ended up suing OHSU, and here again, that took years for the case to go through, and she eventually won. But what Chris did is she started an organization called the Coalition of Domestic Partners. And that's another thing that went on, and that besides potlucks, there are all these coalitions, you know, come and went. So I went to the very first meeting, and there must have been 50 people in the room. I was the only one there representing a private company. Everyone else was either Multnomah County or the city of Portland or whatever. And they were had to work through their union and the PERS representative, things like that. So it was entirely different from what I needed to do. But it was great to know that I wasn't alone. And we were so desperate for information. We had one woman in that group who worked for the Multnomah County Library. I'm sorry, I've forgotten her name, but she was just, man, she was so good at research. And she's the one who got us the most information in terms of what other employees companies were doing. Did it cost anything? No, it really didn't. That's just what people said to you. And like, she put me in touch with Lotus Corporation back in either Massachusetts or Maine. I don't remember where they were. And I wrote to them and blah, blah, blah. And they wrote back to me and they sent me all this stuff. And they said, however, this isn't official. I need to have my human resource people talk to their human resource people. So I'm running out of time. So while this was going on, at Tektronix, the people I kept dealing with kept changing. So first I'd be with Ed Niebert, and then he'd leave, and he'd go, you know, I'm passing this off to Libby Johnson. Well, who the hell's Libby Johnson? You know. So now I go meet Libby Johnson, and she, you know, okay, I explain the whole story again, yada, yada, you know. And then I wouldn't hear anything, and I'd go back, and I'd be emailing, and, oh, Libby's gone. Now you need to talk to David Franks. And this just kept going for, like I say, three and a half years. And in the middle of all that, Tektronix hired a diversity manager. I should also say that in the middle of that, my partner left me, so now I had no partner, but I'm still trying to get benefits. And and there was somebody in Chris Tanner's organization who also didn't have a partner at that time, and she was going to put an ad in Just Out. There's Marty Davis back there. She wanted to put an ad in Just Out that said, you know, have benefits, need partner. And I don't know if she ever... I don't know if she ever did that or not, but it's a great line. I love that line. But anyhow, so I went to meet the diversity manager, and he told me that he said, I have it down here someplace, that I shouldn't expect immediate action. And this was 2 years after I'd first started, but that he was working on a mission statement. So I thought, okay. So... yada, yada. So we just keep going. And eventually, and I'm running out of time, I ended up talking to David Franks. And the first thing that David Franks heard about is he wanted to find this letter and destroy it. Now, I don't know where it went at Tektronix. I haven't a clue, but I have all these Xerox copies. And they kept saying to me that it's almost a go. It's almost a go. And in June of 1994... I was pretty sure it was going to go. Okay, one more minute. And I met David in the cafeteria in August of 1994, and he said that it was not going to happen. And I was really upset about that, and he said that the Tektronix, what did they say? The domestic partner health coverage would be something that people could point to, and tech didn't want that because they, as the mythical they, have made changes to the program that some people may not like, because Tektronix was going to roll out a whole new benefits package. And David assured me, though, that the program was not dropped because of the gay issue. I don't know where else it would have been dropped. And it continued like this until finally, in February of 1995, I just gave up. I kept this log of the whole time of what was going on. And I had had a lunch with some of the vice presidents. They were having these like group lunches to have employees come have lunch with them and talk about our issues, and everybody would feel good. Of course, they were really pissed that I ended up being at lunch one day because I was not a happy employee. And I just really was hammering at them, like, you know, I don't feel like I'm included at Tektronix. You're rolling out this whole big package. You've got these fancy flyers and brochures and emails, and it was supposed to be this rah-rah moment. And I wanted them to know that when they looked at me, that I would be an employee who's not participating in that. So I always felt a little left out at Tektronix. On the plus side, though, Multnomah County did extend benefits. They passed it in 1992, and they started offering it in July 1st, 1993. And a lot of that work was because of all those individual folks who showed up at, like, Chris Tanner's meetings. And then in 1994, the city of Portland offered domestic partners to, you know, benefits. To this day, I'm pretty sure that Tektronix does not offer. And my story is told in this book, and the only reason I want to bring this up is because the author got the ending completely wrong. So I was really shocked when I read it. It said that Tektronix paid for my education, which is not true. I got my master's degree while all this was going on, and I paid for that, and I also worked full-time for Tektronix, and she said half-time, so it's just a little minor detail. But, you know, and I have one more thing that I did meet my new partner, Fern, over there, so at Tektronix, which is amazing because there weren't that many lesbians there, you know. And then Tektronix, my division was the color printer division, which is now owned by Xerox, which is in Wilsonville. And we would always have these summer employee picnics. I mean, I absolutely dreaded these things because I just didn't feel like I belonged, you know. And so, okay, they were going to have yet another picnic. And so I thought, okay, I'll go. And I opened up the door to go outside into this courtyard area, and there were all these gay rainbow flags, like 15 of them or so. I believe it's because whoever bought those flags thought, hey, we're the color printer division, and it was colorful. They didn't know. I mean, I was like, oh my God, it's the gay flag. I was so happy. That's like the one time, other than meeting my partner Fern, that I felt, you know, felt like I belonged, but I was the only one who was in on the joke because they didn't know about it. So, okay, that's it for me. Thank you.
Well, wow. Each one of you was more fascinating than the one before. It was just great. I don't know if, as I mentioned to you before, if you want to have some between you, that's great, or we can go to Q&A.
I have a question for Cliff, that when I teach this capstone class, I came across something that was published in the Portland Town Council newsletter about stereotypes that gay men and lesbians had about each other. And some of my friends here heard me talk about this, and I don't know if you remember it or not, but it's really powerful for my students to see that yes, people had all these stereotypes about gay people, but gay people had stereotypes about each other. And do you remember going to any of those sessions? Do you want me to tell you what some of them were? It'd be like lesbians thought the gay men, you know, wore their pants too tight and were good dancers. And do you remember that? I mean, because you mentioned it was TKO, so can you talk a bit about the men and the women not getting along that I've heard about?
Yeah, I think that that while we were dealing with what are we going to call gay pride in the future, it really was about getting to facing that we knew very little about each other, okay. And that we were full of stereotypes. And You know, I think that for gay men, for some of us, it was really about facing our sexism. And so while the focus was the name, the outcome was really about 40 people building, getting to know each other and deciding to work together over time and really learning about each other. So I think the point that you raise is really important. And I remember at Black Lesbians and Gays United, I'll never forget it. We, you know, at the end of the meeting, we would plan the next meeting. And there was this young black gay man who said, yeah, we'll meet next month, and the women will cook. And, the, and you know, he could hardly get it out before. There was a barrage of, oh, no, I don't, you know, just sort of like correcting him. But, you know, so we're coming, here we are as black men and black women meeting together, and all of those stereotypes and biases and assumptions are right there. So I think it's interesting.
You are listening to a panel of lesbian, gay, bi, trans, queer activists speaking on the history of LGBTQ activism in Portland. It was recorded on October 24th as part of the History of Social Justice Organizing series. The activists on the panel are Steve Fulmer, Susie Shepard, Cliff Jones, and Pat Young. This is KBOO Portland.
And I will comment on that as well. In my remarks, I pointed out that I started out as this string bean gay hippie at Portland State University, and I soon moved into the working world, also at Portland State University, and moved into middle management. So by the time I got into the 1980s, oh my God, I was a white man in a suit. So I just want to, and I learned to work at that level and to work with people that were serving on community boards and that, held positions. And I did much the same thing. My politics really didn't change very much, but my methodologies changed. And so I don't mean, I'm not jumping to the defense of white men in suits. I just mean to say that it takes all of us, okay? And we all have our different ways of working. To borrow a phrase, it takes the village. And it's very important, I believe, that we respect each other's different ways of contributing, because it will take all of us to reach the goal.
Well, and I'll comment from a different perspective on that, too, because at that time, the women's movement was, there was a lot of lesbian separatism going on at that time. And the women, I got constantly trashed for my work at Portland Town Council by gay women. And for me, gay was just like the word to use. And I know you addressed that from the other standpoint. But, I mean, when I came out, it was like we were gay, we're a gay man or a gay woman. And that was like the umbrella also for trans, bi, I mean, the whole shebang. And I still identify as a gay woman because I was so constantly being told, you're a male-identified woman, you should be, coming to our potlucks and so on and doing all this. And I was so involved in the work that we were doing with the legislature and community organizing and so on. I just, I didn't want to sit around and process. I just wanted to go for the gusto. So I got trashed a lot for that. The other thing I want to mention was, and you talked about next month being your mountain moving thing, and I mean, Kristen is like synonymous with Mountain Moving Cafe. I don't know how many Sundays during legislative sessions we would spend at Mountain Moving Cafe having postcard writing campaigns, letter writing campaigns. I mean, that was the place to be. I mean, if you had any kind of movement going on, and certainly in the early days of the gay rights movement, Mountain Moving was where it was happening.
Anything else? Should I? Yeah. Okay. Hold on. Let me bring you this so that it gets recorded.
All right. Hi, Carl Rohde. I really appreciate holding this event and hope that it is the genesis for a OPB Oregon Experience episode, which really should be brought to a broader audience. I also really appreciate the fact that you brought up the silver lining of the AIDS crisis and how it galvanized the community, while at the same time the terror of that age sent a large portion of the population back into the closet, people like myself, actually, that were probably on the verge of coming out, but the stigma in society regarding mosquitoes and sneezes was such that we all went to running back into the closet. I really think that from my own, and I'd like to hear more from each of you, the galvanizing moment in Oregon and the two people that made the biggest difference in advancing gay rights in Oregon were Lon Mabon and Scott Lively, and how they really made me and many other people realize that we've got our best in, we have to get involved. Can you comment on that?
I think one of the things that, I mean, yes, you're right. I mean, and although at the end of ballot measure 9, it was interesting because Lon Mabon was on TV saying, I forget what the question was, but it was so true, because a lot of people who have been involved in the movement have talked about how fractured we all became after that. And Mabon said, I've got the gay community right where I want them, at each other's necks. And there was a lot of bloodshed within the community, it definitely galvanized. I mean, we had to fight those horrible, horrible, awful people. But that's, when you said that, I just remember that one quote from him and how god-awfully too that was. And now here's Scott Lively off in Africa just reinventing that godforsaken wheel.
I totally agree, and I often like to say the same thing, that if we're going to have an enemy, let them be as wacko as possible, because they have a tendency to to push that so-called silent majority, the kind of the complacent middle that would really prefer not to think at all. They tend to push those people to the left, even as they do galvanize people who agree with them. That's not to say that they're not dangerous. And certainly Scott Lively, when he couldn't get when he couldn't raise enough money to buy his postage stamps in Oregon any longer, found other audiences that were more receptive. And so now we're seeing some unparalleled hatred and persecution going on in Africa and in Russia and in the Baltic states. So, we have to take these people seriously, and we have to do everything that we can to support the work that's there. Those of us in America tend to be very xenophobic, we tend to think that we are the world. And in fact, there are people just like us in other places that need support from abroad.
I think that, the anti-gay initiatives, that was I would say that was a dark period. And I think it did reveal political variance in our community. And within the community, there was a huge power struggle over what is the message. And in some ways, from my perspective, that power struggle came along privileged lines, and in the early 80s, Margaret Sloan came, who was a black lesbian activist from the Bay Area, came to spoke at Gay Pride, and she said, "Multiple oppression offers multiple perception." And, I've never forgot that the more layers of oppression you experience, the clearer your lens is about what's going on is. And the fewer layers that you experience, the harder it is to see what's going on. And so I think that we had to struggle around what is the message, what is the approach, what is our political framework. And you know, one thing it reveals is that we're not all the same. You know, we're as multicultural and multipolitical as any other community. I remember, I think it was it was early 90s, and I was at work, and I got a call about 3 o'clock. Could I come to that show they had on Town Hall? Could I come to Town Hall? Because they didn't have any people, you know, it was the OCA and the pro-gay agenda was a topic, and there were no people of color there for gay people. And, you know, the one person they had couldn't make it, so could I come? So I went, very unprepared, not briefed. You know, the OCA had 5 black women there who were very vocal, had been very briefed, had been filled with a lot of misinformation. And so, you know, it was difficult for me. If the OCA can, you know, organize communities of color, why can't we be a more inclusive movement? And I think we've come a long way since then. You know, I think Basic Rights Oregon is a great example of organization based in the lesbian, gay, bi, trans community that has understood that the way we win is by working cross issue, that we have to work around race, class, gender, we have to work around all those issues, or we can't expect people to be there to fight for our issues. So I think, you know, in the last 20 years, we have really learned how to partner. We have really learned how to introspectively understand that we have the same challenges that the rest of society faces, and we have to be in dialogue, we have to be in transformation on all those issues if we expect to win on our own. So, you know, I think that we came out of those anti-gay initiatives stronger, that there really was discourse in our community to look at those issues, and it wasn't pretty, but I do think we came out stronger.
More questions? Comments?
Well, let me mention a couple things.
Wait, hold on, George. I want you to have the mic.
Since he's standing, this is George McCullough, that I've pointed to several times.
So I want to point out also that I think that BRL has done a lot of really great things. One of them is making racial justice a priority and also making transgender justice a priority. One of the things I think Carl mentioned, and Carl, can I tell them you were voted to office openly gay, so he's sort of a pioneer there. You were voted to the city council of Lake Oswego, right? So we have quite a few LGBT people that have been elected in Oregon that are fully out and fully open when they were elected. But you mentioned hoping to do something in OPB, and we have done a few videos for Glappin, and they're on our site. Susie has participated in some of those. But the really incredible thing I think that BRO has done is they've done a series of videos, and some of them center around racial equality. They interview people who are African American or Latino, or they also have some on Asian Americans and Native Americans, and they're really outstanding. And probably the best, I think, is the one done on the Edwards family. Khalil Edwards is a black gay activist with Basic Rights Oregon, and also with a group that's very effective called PFLAG Portland Black Chapter. And his parents are also very, have participated in the movement a lot. His mother just won a special award for her participation. So if you get a chance, you might go to YouTube, and I think you can just query Basic Rights Oregon and see some of those videos, because the one in the Edwards family is really outstanding. So we have a lot of things. I'd like to see more videos on us as well, and maybe one of these days we can get something together in OPB as well. Thank you.
Are there other questions? George? Oh, there is. Okay. Oh, yes. No, happy to have you comment, my dear.
I'm I just wanted to follow up on something that I heard Cliff say. I'm Kristen Knapp, and I've been an activist in the community since way back. I heard something you said, Cliff, about the importance of those TKO conversations, meeting together over time and getting to understand who each other is and where you're coming from. And that made me remember about the Conversations Project, which was something that I put together at the end of the 90s to try to heal from what you somebody mentioned up there about falling apart after Scott Lively and Mabon said, oh, we have the community where we want them. Now they're at each other's throats. We were at each other's throats, and we were really suffering, all of us, from it. And so some of us felt that we had to do something to try to bring the community back into conversation with each other so we could at least sit in the same room and not just be hating each other so much. Because it was just horrible that what had happened to us. So we did this Conversations Project, and we met in small groups with representatives of different identities within the community together in a group over time, week after week. And then at the end of like 10 weeks of meeting together, the group was charged with doing something that they could share with the community, like a panel discussion like this, or something that they, as a group, would figure out what it would be. And it turned out that all the different small groups got together and did a theatrical presentation, which we did at IFCC Theater, and it was called Transparencies. And it really brought out into the community, I think, for one of maybe the first time in a public way, about trans people having a role in our community, and that we were all able to acknowledge each other in different ways and see what we had in common and what we had that was different. So I do have a video of that. And at some point, you know, it's possible maybe that could be included in some kind of historical thing, too, about the community.
I was going to ask you, George, if you wanted to talk. Now I forgot my question, but maybe a little more about Glaupen.
Well, I dropped out of our movement in 1974 because I had to get a job, and I was running out of money. I'd been living on savings, and I swore I would never go back into politics again. But Glaupen, in the process of writing history, has drawn me back into the movement, and I've been increasingly involved. I think that it's hard to explain, but to me, history plays a really important role in motivating people to continue social change. I think you can't know or fully understand where you are now unless you understand the past. And we still have a long way to go, but I think that having the perspective and the sense of identity we get from history allows us to continue. We are no means in a space where we have full equality. We still don't have marriage equality in Oregon. The majority of states, it's still legal to fire someone for being gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender, and we have no federal civil rights protection, no law that protects us on a federal level. So I think history helps us understand that, and also helps with the bigotry that we still see and the type of bullying and the prejudice that we run into all the time.
We did earlier. Yeah, and really their website just has fabulous, fabulous resources.
Gay, Lesbian Archives in the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
But it's fully inclusive. It includes trans people as well. So. Right.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank all of you, everyone in this room, for being here, and of course, especially our speakers and George, who has been very helpful with this, and Kristen, who was very helpful in helping get this together.
You are listening to a panel of lesbian, gay, bi, trans, queer activists speaking on the history of LGBTQ activism in Portland. It was recorded on October 24th as part of the History of Social Justice Organizing series. The activists on the panel are Steve Fulmer, Susie Shepherd, Cliff Jones, and Pat Young. This is KBOO Portland.
walks in parks at 6 in the morning, shirking work and drinking all day. Tingles tingling through me seem foreign. I want to be sure that the tingle endures. I want to be sure that you love me. You got me going, showing my feelings, feeling frantic, fragile and free. Giving, stuck, but getting excited. I want to be sure that the giving is yours. I want to be sure that you love me. Clinging, clutching, caring, connecting, bending, caught, engaged, to confine. Racing, running, riding, reflecting. I just had to see that the caring's for me. I just had to see that you love me.
You can decide.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University with 5 part-time MBA programs that combine classic business skills with an emphasis on creative thinking, ethical decision-making, and sound judgment, the hallmarks of a liberal arts perspective. December 5th evening information session at details at merrillhurst.edu. This is KBOO Portland coming up at 10:30. We will hear a panel discussion on the history of the Mountain Moving Cafe, exploring collectives at work. This program was recorded on November 14th as part of the History of Social Justice Organizing series. Thank you, Jenka Soderberg and Tom Hood, for recording this program. The panelists who will be speaking are Ellen Goldberg, Andy Clark, Kieran O'Hara, and Peter Thacker. The panel is introduced by Sandy Polishuk, the organizer of the History of Social Justice series. And here it is.
Now, on to Mountain Movie Cafe, a beloved institution. I'm not going to tell you about it, though, but I am going to introduce these 4 members of the original collective who still live in Portland, and I just want to say I'm really grateful that you all agreed to be here tonight. As I was coming here, I was thinking about it, and I realized that they were all teachers, but Peter and Andy went on to make teaching their lifetime career, and Ellen and Kira are both cultural workers. Kira is a musician, and Ellen is a poet, and this so perfectly represents what Mountain Moving was, which was an educational, cultural, community, institution, gathering place, and restaurant. really, really pleased to have them all here. I'm just going to tell you briefly what's been going on in their lives since the cafe. Andy worked as a laborer for how many years, did you say?